Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? Hey, people. On the podcast today, we have Heather Dominic, who is a really nice lady. And she is a coach, because we're in the coaching series. And she coaches highly sensitive entrepreneurs, or as she labels them, HSEs, which is a very unusual angle. And she is the only person that coaches these people on the planet. And it's kind of interesting. I'm not sure if everyone has a bit of highly sensitiveness in them or not. And so I'm a bit confused about this entire area, but it was really nice to unpack it with her and perhaps diagnose myself as one of them, still unsure. Regardless, she has amazing advice around life, running a business, generally being a useful person. And yeah, it was a really, really fun podcast with her and exploring the world and everything. So I think you will really enjoy it, and you'll learn lots about being creative instead of be like complaining about things and not being such a perfectionist, which is a massive issue that I have myself, instead of being more productive and having a process for things. So yeah, watch out for that. She's got some interesting stuff. She used to live a few miles from where 9/11 actually happened. So that was a massive event in her life, and it's a good podcast. She's a fascinating lady. You will enjoy it.
So I live in Manhattan, New York. I grew up in upstate New York, which is a very different place than New York City. 4.5 hours north, mountains, streams, but always knew that I was meant to live in New York City. I made my way down, went to graduate school at NYU, started my first career as a high school teacher, drama teacher. Had the privilege of working with Bette Midler in an inner city school. Survived 9/11, living just over a mile from ground zero. Started my first business just 2 years after 9/11. And though I couldn't have said it at the time, probably because of 9/11. First business as a nutrition and wellness coach. Built that business up to full capacity in 9 months' time. Had no idea what I was doing. Was absolutely terrified. Started making the transition into business coaching because others wanted to know what I was doing to be able to have a full-time practice as a person in a field of wellness. And from there, crossed the $1 million mark and entered into a dark night of the soul, which led me to understand that I am a highly sensitive person. And from there started what is the highly sensitive entrepreneur movement, which I have been leading for almost 10 years now, and have developed a great body of work to teach highly sensitives how to be successfully self-employed long term. I have been married to my sweetheart husband for 13 years. We've been together for 17. And I probably am the happiest I have ever been.
Cool. You said you grew up in upstate New York, which I've always heard these terms like Manhattan and upstate and things. And I mean, I've been to New York and through the countryside, but I didn't actually realize that upstate just meant like the sort of the countryside part of it. And in terms of size, it's kind of like the size of England and someone being from London or not London. I'm from the middle of nowhere and people are just never quite get it. And yeah, it's kind of funny that New York is more just thought of as the city and not really the place.
Yeah, so much more.
It's fascinating. Yeah, I guess I'd like to know a bit more about your childhood, really. Like, what were the things that really interested you as a young person? So were you like an introvert, would you say? Is that part of your sensitivity? Where did that come from?
Well, you know, one is though a person might be highly sensitive, it doesn't mean that they're necessarily introverted. Yet I was definitely a very quiet and shy child. I grew up an only child and was totally fine with that. I never had like a feeling of like, oh, I really wish I had brothers and sisters. I loved my space. I loved having my own room. I loved being quiet. I didn't know, of course, that I was highly sensitive, but looking back, it all makes sense. I can't really talk about my childhood without talking about the fact that my mother died when I was 14 in a bicycle accident. And so that was definitely a defining moment of before and after, and was actually my first foray into working with A Course in Miracles, which is a psychological and spiritual curriculum. And that has definitely influenced my work today, and hence the name A Course in Business Miracles.
Did you feel quite different to your friends in general, sort of having all your own space when your friends were maybe like more talkative and doing different things, or did you just never think about these things?
Not when I was younger, not at all. I didn't feel different and didn't think about that very much. And, you know, my friends, we tended to be like just a very creative, imaginative bunch. And so I think that kind of just naturally worked with my sensitive nature. Being a teenager, that was a whole different story. So one, like losing a parent during that time is, again, a massive definer. And I definitely started to feel like, oh, you know, I am different. And I felt like I had to work really hard, which I could do, to fit in and kind of, you know, match up to what was interesting, you know, to the majority of other teenagers that I was with in school and whatnot. And that is definitely also a very similar theme in most of the highly sensitive entrepreneurs that I mentor. You know, somewhere along the line, there suddenly is a sense of being very different and then needing to learn how to cope with that. So a lot of the work that I do is to teach HSEs how to go beyond coping, just coping in their life, because if you're actually interested in being successfully self-employed, you need to be able to exist beyond coping and really move into the realm of creating, because that's what, you know, entrepreneurialism is. It's an act of creation for sure.
Yeah, sure. No, that's really fascinating. Two reasons. I guess like when I was younger, I was quite different and still am in many ways. But I remember sort of hanging out with some of my friends that, and like, I'd feel sort of like, why the hell are they hanging out with me? And then they'd like speak all the time and tell jokes and would be funny. And I'd be like, but I don't speak. Like, what the hell am I even bringing? Why do they hang out with me? I must be so boring. And I was like, what are they getting out of us two hanging out together if I'm kind of like just listening to him all the time and he's the one telling funny stories? And it was only later I was like, well, maybe people like having their stories listened to. And, oh, okay. Actually, it's a perfect reason for us to be best friends. But I was remember being quite baffled as to the fact that I was completely unlike this person that I liked. And was like, well, if I'm not like him, why does he even like me, kind of thing?
Yeah, it's definitely a highly sensitive trait and experience. In my work, I've come to define what I refer to as HSE shadows and HSE strengths. And one of our top HSE strengths is that we are deep listeners. And you are exactly right. People really liked to be heard, of course. And that leads to like what I refer to in my work as the stranger incident. So most of us who are highly sensitive know the experience of the stranger incident. And that is where a stranger will seek you out. So not even just your friends, right, that you're hanging out with like you described, but strangers, subway, bus, grocery store, parties will find you and just divulge their deepest, darkest secrets to you. And then they're like, nice to meet you. And they're off. And the highly sensitive is left there feeling like, whoa, really just completely flooded with everything that has just been basically like dumped into their nervous system. But that's because we have that skill. We are deep listeners for sure.
You reckon that like nearly all highly sensitive entrepreneurs have this thing, a stranger incident?
Yeah, most highly sensitives have that experience. And typically what happens is they go into a form of protection because their nervous system, you know, just becomes stimulated by taking in, you know, all of this energy or information. And so the work that I do is between those shadows and those strengths is to really learn how to work with your highly sensitive nervous system, your highly sensitive nature, your abilities, your qualities, so that they can really be working for you when you need them to work for you in your business and not working against you. So it's a real training process. Otherwise, again, most highly sensitives didn't grow up with anyone really teaching them how to work with their system. Because one, this is not something I invented. You know, the term and phrase highly sensitive comes from the work of Dr. Elaine Aron, who's a psychologist and researcher. And she's identified through her research that there's 20% of us in the world who are born highly sensitive. And no one really was taught like how to work with the fact that your nervous system is wired differently than the other 80%. And so there's a retraining process that needs to happen so that you don't have to keep running into the stranger incident, for example.
I mean, I feel like the stranger incident is something that maybe, despite me saying that I don't get it as such, as like I didn't feel unique about it. So I feel like everyone's had like some random person come and dump things on them. And I sort of feel like some of the stuff you're talking about as a highly sensitive person is more generic than 20% of people. It's sort of like people like to feel like they're unique and things, and then telling them that they're like sensitive and stuff is like actually most people do have times when they are being sensitive and don't feel listened to and stuff. And so it kind of just like anyone could define themselves as highly sensitive.
Well, one is that it's not you're either highly sensitive or you're not. Right?
Yeah, as in you can be introvert and extrovert at the same time. So
yeah. So there's, you can think of it, you know, almost like, I want to use the word spectrum, but I don't want to use that and confuse it with other ways that that word is used. But it's not that someone who isn't highly sensitive isn't sensitive at all. It's just to a degree. So according to Dr. Aron's research, those who are highly sensitive, basically your nervous system is wired to take in stimulation at a higher level, to a higher degree than someone who is not. So in that way, it is subtle, like you're speaking of, and it does absolutely make a difference in terms of how it is that you show up in the world, how it is that you relate in the world, how it is that you operate, and being able to understand that when it comes to being self-employed can really make the difference between a service-based business owner making it or not.
Okay, well, I'm sorry for dragging the point a bit, but it's actually really helpful to hear your explanation going deeper, because when you first started, I kind of had alarm bells of being like, well, actually, you just be very generic and it sounds like anyone could be this person. But that explanation made a lot more sense to me. And like, I definitely do feel like I'm someone that does overthink things a lot and does take stuff a lot more seriously. And you sort of see so many people that just seem to not have any of these issues in their head, just walking around being like, oh, something happens, and they just don't let it affect them. Like, wow, why do I like have to completely overthink this thing so much? And
totally. I mean, I ask those kind of questions all the time when I was younger, and definitely before I understood that I was highly sensitive. I was like, oh my gosh, what is wrong with me? Why? Why does it seem like this is no big deal to, you know, 8 people out of the 10 of us who are standing here? But this is registering, you know, so intensely for me. And more than anything, I used to just wish it would go away. Like, could I please just not, you know, take this in, you know, so intensely? But again, now I understand why. And more importantly, I understand how to work with it and manage it so that it's working in my favor and not against me.
Yeah, because it is like a really good skill to be able to overthink things and actually sort of get more to the bottom of stuff. It's just knowing when to apply it and use it effectively and not have it like keep you awake all night and never thinking.
Exactly. that's really the difference between, you know, working on the shadow side of the highly sensitive nature or in your strengths. But it really requires like a set of skills, skills such as like really learning how to set boundaries, skills to first and foremost, just understand, you know, who you are, what you need, to ask for what it is that you need, to be able to clearly communicate, to accept the fact that maybe what it is that you need is different than, you know, the other people who are in a room, to be okay with that. And also that you can really put those skills to use. You can really be of service in your business. You can be well compensated. You can set up your life so that you, you know, feel like not like the odd one out, but instead like, you know, really grounded and confident and, you know, peaceful in what it is that you choose to do and choose not to do can be amazing. And it's a process.
Yeah, there's definitely things that I did have a lot of problems with, but like I said, I did learn to set boundaries and I have got much better at clearly communicating what I'm aiming for, and definitely got very, very all right with being different. And I kind of went through a phase of being kind of quite unpopular, the point where I became stupidly popular when I was like 16 and sort of got drunk, did lots of cool stuff. And then by 20, I kind of stopped caring and was like, actually, I just want to do exactly me things. And yeah, my personality kind of took a bit of a dive and was just like, well, this is how I do stuff. And if someone doesn't have time, then that doesn't matter, because why do I want to spend time with this person anyway?
Yeah, well, that's fantastic. I would say, you know, and again, I don't know if you're highly sensitive or not, but most highly sensitive don't have that kind of clarity so early on, number one. And then number two, when it comes to being in business and suddenly your livelihood, you know, depends on how it is that you're able to interact with others, there becomes some detangling that has to happen. And you have to get really clear of like, okay, wait, being of service in my business isn't about being liked. So it's not about that. Okay, so I don't want to care about that. But at the same time, I want to really be able to use these skills and talents that I have to really make a difference for somebody else. Okay, now I have to learn how to clearly be able to communicate that and to receive compensation for it. And really, once again, understand that it's not about being liked or not, popular or not, and it's not personal, but it's really about the skills that I have to offer, knowing that I can really make a difference and knowing that someone investing in that really is something that they can do for themselves that will be very beneficial. So again, there's kind of like one, sounds like you peaked really early, which yay you. And two, then there's another level that really needs to be understood as a person who's self-employed.
On the podcast, I guess I've started getting a lot of requests from people trying to be on my podcast. And because it's got really popular lately. And like when people do come on, they get like a lot of follow-ups and things. And so it makes sense that lots of people want to come on. But then I feel, because I'm kind of quite sensitive, that I'm getting used. Like a lot of people, you know, they won't listen to my podcast or something beforehand and they'll come on and they'll just have like this quick like hour long call. It's a bit like just sort of work to them and it's not really like building a relationship. And I take that really personally because I love connecting with people on the podcast and making something like really interesting happen. And then I feel a bit like, all right, why have I put all this time into editing this thing to this person that just turned up for like half an hour and said some stuff and then like walked away and didn't think about it again. And I'm like, what am I doing? Yeah, is that like a highly sensitive thing? And do you think that I was trying to protect myself by being a bit more of a dick to people that I'm not sure about?
Well, I would say it does sound like it could possibly be a highly sensitive aspect because it sounds like you're thinking very deeply about the process. And that is also one of our strengths, right? Again, like we're deep listeners, we're deep thinkers, we're deep feelers for sure. And we're not going to be the person typically who is just about small chat, right? Like we're really interested in making really valuable, deep connections. So, you know, for example, if you go to a party or just even networking, most likely you're going to be the person who maybe talks to one or two or three people, but has like really genuine connections. And you can remember, you know, what it is that you know, you exchange with this person. So that sounds like it's something very similar that's happening or what you are desiring to experience via the podcast, which I can really relate to, which is one of the reasons why I love being on podcasts. One, I don't have to leave my apartment. two, I can really connect deeply, you know, with one person and have like a really valuable conversation. And I've just met some incredible people, you know, the podcast world, which I never would have met otherwise. As far as being a dick, that sounds like what I would refer to as an HSE coping mechanism. So there's three that I've identified, which is that either you have the coping mechanism of being a pusher, the coping mechanism of being a hider, or the coping mechanism of being a combo platter. And it's really just exactly that. Like you said, like you learn how to cope in the world. But like I was speaking to earlier, you want to go beyond coping as a person who's self-employed and be able to get into creating. So, you know, there's probably ways that you can set those boundaries about who does and does not come on your podcasts, and you don't have to feel like a dick.
Surviving 9/11 and things, like how did that affect your life?
Oh, massively affected my life. You know, for those of us, I mean, one, obviously it was a global event, right? And for those of us who were living in the city, it definitely had a major effect. And for those of us who were living close to the event, which I was, I would say, you know, even more so. And I don't think I could have said it at the time, but, you know, my experience in hindsight, as well as just, you know, consistent conversations with friends is, you know, first and foremost, it was living through a traumatic event, right? Seeing and experiencing your city completely shut down. The area that I lived was closed off for weeks. So no cars, had to show ID to be able to just get home. The air quality was awful. And the understanding that part of why the air quality was awful was not just because of the collapsing of the building, but because of all of the people who had perished as part of that. It was literally in the air. So there's that. Then there was the way that it completely changed the city. It was kind of a defining marker. There was those of us in New York who were like, absolutely not. I am staying here no matter what. And there was people who moved within weeks. They were gone, out. So there's that. The whole energy of the city completely changed. At that time, I was a major swing dancer. And there was a beautiful, vibrant swing dancing scene in the city that completely shut down. Businesses closed. People lost work. I definitely was impacted in terms of working as a teacher. I had an after-school position that kind of just helped me get by. And that closed. There's nothing. Those programs gone. One day they were there. Next day, no. And then there was this kind of bigger aspect of a real sense of whatever you want to do in your life, do it. Because time is very limited. So I already had that as part of my experience of losing a parent at a young age, and then to live through something such as 9/11 really compounded it. And so I, you know, again, I probably couldn't have said it at the time, but looking back, it's probably why I chose to start my own business. There was also the aspects like where I was very frustrated within the school system because it was very limiting, etc. And there was this real, again, sense within the entire energy of the city of do not wait, because everything can change in an instant. And otherwise, I don't know if I would have just left such a clear, structured system to suddenly be like, hey, I'm going to be self-employed, even though I have no idea how to do that, and kind of just launch myself, you know, into a business. But I did. And I would say that's probably, again, a big part of that was 9/11.
Yeah, it's funny the way like you need sometimes big, impactful situations on your life to really make you step back and be like, wait, what the hell am I doing with my life? This is the thing I need to do. And we just kind of walk through taking the things that are in front of us as they are. And
yep. I also met my husband the year later, literally September 2002. And before that, I was just a mess. I could not sustain a romantic relationship to like save my life. And everything changed you know? So, yeah.
What made you go and do working in schools? Because, I mean, I really like teaching and things. So were you just quite enjoying that in many ways? Is that why you became a teacher?
Yeah, I am a teacher at heart for sure. I am still a teacher. That is first and foremost in terms of how I work in the Business Miracles mentoring programs. It's a natural part of my skill set. I loved my students. I love my students. I worked at two high schools in the 8 years that I taught as a teacher, and very, very different environments. And I loved them all. I loved my students. The systems, not so much. But teaching, yes, really just a joy.
Yeah, it's funny. And I guess it's like we have a lot of things that we want to do, but then we don't realize the other implications of it. As in sort of what do you want to fight for? What are like sort of what's the actual pain that you want in your life that you're going to be dealing with all the time? And as an entrepreneur, you know, there's lots of problems that you have to deal with, but clearly you like these problems more than you like the problems of being a teacher.
Well, because, you know, also one of our highly sensitive entrepreneurial strengths is we are very creative as highly sensitives. So yes, being an entrepreneur brings absolutely tons of issues, tons of problems, and allows me to be in creative solution mode versus a very antiquated system. I don't know, maybe England is more advanced, although I'm thinking not. But, you know, the public school system in the US has some areas of improvement that they could be giving attention to. And that antiquated system was very confining for me. And so it's not whether it's about problems or not problems, right? But what's available in terms of systems and support to be able to be working again in that space of creative solution, which I love and I'm happy to do because it means I am alive. I am not the person who's just going to be okay, you know, with my head down, day to day, same routine, 9 to 5, go home, same routine, go to sleep, wake up, do it all over again. I prefer to be, you know, with my hands, you know, fully deep in the process of how can we make this better? And I get to do that every single day.
Yeah, 100%. I hate complaining about things. It just seems like a waste of time. I want to be actively dealing with them. And like when you're in a system where all you can do is complain, it's just really unempowering. And as an entrepreneur, you can always creatively be dealing with your problems. And then sure, you've got like 20 and you can only deal with two of them. So that's all you do is you focus on the two of them and you kind of accept the other 20. And then you like iterate on and you sort of be creative about stuff you can work on. And it's really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Creating versus complaining. And even better, which I also feel like I am so privileged to have the experience of, is to be working within a team structure where everyone is called upon to utilize their strengths and to add their part to the creative solution is beautiful, brilliant. I'm thrilled that I get to experience that on a day-to-day basis with my team.
Cool. Interesting. And then I also wanted to go into talking a bit more about the major event of having your mother die at 14. And quite an interesting angle is that we just spoke about the creating versus complaining. And like, did you find it hard as someone that doesn't like complaining, having the kind of issue that you can't really complain to other people about, but it's like really affecting you and you can't just sort of creatively magic yourself out of the problem of having your mum die kind of thing?
Yes. Well, I would say, you know, again, all in hindsight, but now I look back and I remember I was very embarrassed by the fact that my mother had died. And I know that might sound really weird, but I was already unconsciously aware that I was different. And to have this attention brought to me because of something, as you're speaking to, that was out of my control and also devastatingly out of my control. It was really, really difficult. And it clashed that part of me that kind of just really wanted to be like, okay, like, let's just get on with things, right?
The last thing you need is someone to be like, oh, can you like, yeah, don't stop dealing with me. I just want to be a normal person rather than the person in the weird like corner of someone being dealt with.
Exactly, which caused a whole lot of issues that needed to be dealt with in the years of the fallout. But I'm very fortunate that I have been able to.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear. Thanks for sharing that. Okay, and then back to you starting your first business. How did you go about, like, where did that first idea come from to go and start this business?
I think the energy of 9/11, you know, really permeated that time. And I was feeling restless and I was feeling, you know, frustrated. And at that point, I was working in the second school. I'd already made a major change. The first school that I worked in was a very affluent school in the suburbs. I had to commute a far way from where I lived in the city to out to that suburban school. Again, I loved those students dearly, felt very frustrated with that system. So I had kind of done the opposite of what most people in education do, which is I left this very affluent environment. I left a really, you know, in terms of education, a high paying position. And I took a position in the inner city, took a pay cut, working with a different population, and again, loved my students, and still found myself frustrated with the system. So by that point, I understood, okay, this isn't about this school, right? This is going to, doesn't matter if it's an affluent school, if it's an inner city school, if it's a private school, if it's a public school. Again, I understand these terms mean something different in England, but I think we get the idea.
Yeah.
So that made me think, okay, then if I'm interested in a change, then it has to be something that's outside of the system that I have found myself in. And my first business was as a nutrition and wellness coach. And I had always been passionate about nutrition and well-being. And I took a certification course just kind of for the heck of it. I think probably, again, in hindsight, looking back, was to distract me, you know, from the day-to-day life post 9/11. And when taking that certification course, which I had started off just for my own self-interest, and then started to think like, yeah, you know what, I could really help others with this. So, you know, those were the steps. And then I'll add in a big old dose of naivete.
Central for any entrepreneur, definitely.
You know, had me somehow, you know, just fully jumping in, and that's that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've read there's actually like a peak amount of procrastination that someone has to have good ideas and be creative and actually start things. And if you don't procrastinate at all, you actually don't do like the interesting things. And if you procrastinate all the time, then you never do anything. But if you sort of procrastinate a bit, like you sort of like, oh, I wasn't sure what to do, I just went and like did something that kind of interested me a bit. It's like, that's where ideas come from, and doing stuff to distract yourself is actually gives you time to have ideas and come up with more stuff. It's actually a good trait of the best entrepreneurs.
Yeah, that's true. I appreciate that angle. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then obviously being very naive is a huge, huge benefit for making you start things. And they do say that no one would ever start the same business a second time, kind of thing, having known all the problems. But regardless, you sort of, if you're aware of how big the mountain is you're about to climb, you wouldn't. But when it looks like a small hill, you're like, oh, there's the top. And then you kind of get slightly closer. It's like, oh, it's got way farther. And you carry on, and then it keeps on getting further and further. And
great metaphor. Absolutely.
It always feels close enough to keep walking, kind of thing.
So true. So true. Great metaphor.
Thank you. I'm trying to work on my metaphors. So, I mean, you kind of just gave it to me anyway. So thanks for making me think of that.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
Okay. And so you started this idea, which as we now know, turned into a mountain. How did you go about the process of, because obviously we got as far as like you just walking up the first hill. So how did you go about the process of building it and then changing things? And well, maybe there's quite a lot to unpack in that first part. I don't know.
Well, I think it goes back to not only being okay with, but really relishing the process of creative solution. So what I find stops so many highly sensitives in being able to have a successful entrepreneurial endeavor is they're caught in that protective mode that we were talking about earlier, right? They're caught in the what I refer to as the coping cycle. And what they believe will allow them to be able to get out of coping is by having everything perfect. That if they can just get everything perfect, then they'll be able to launch the business, or then they'll be able to take the business to the next level, or then they'll be able to, you know, create the income that they desire. And all of that is just one big myth. Right? Who is it? E-Myth? Is that Michael Gerber? I haven't read that in a long time, but that really speaks to that aspect. So for myself, I preferred creative solutions over perfection. And that is something that I definitely still and probably will always, you know, operate within. And if you can release that belief that somehow there is that elusive perfection, you know, place or moment, or I like to refer to it as the myth of arrival, right? That there's just going to be that one spot. And when you get there, it will all be together. And it just is not true. So I've always been willing to using my language is I've always been willing to follow the energy, to just go to the next place that I'm being led to. And when there's a problem, like we've been talking about, that I don't see it as an affront to my well-being. I don't see it as an affront to my personality. I don't see it as an affront to my ability. I see it as an opportunity to learn. Okay, great. So this didn't work in the way that we thought it was going to work. So what can we learn from it? And how can we use that to then go forward? And that really is my philosophy. It's so much of what I teach in terms of how to really be able to engage in assessment, to trade, you know, out perfectionism for process, and then therefore to be on, you know, an ascended growth path and to be willing to be in that growth experience step by step, rather than, again, back to the elusive myth of arrival, but also rather than always just looking for what's going to unlock the quantum leap. And so many people forget, and they should all read Malcolm Gladwell, but forget that actually the quantum leap is really just steps added up intentionally. So that's how I've done it. That's what I continue to do.
Very happy I asked that question. That was a really interesting answer. And I completely relate to everything you said about sort of perfectionism and kind of seeking everything to come together perfectly before like letting things out in the world and letting people deal with it and interact. And just like, no, you definitely just have to start doing things straight away. And something I keep on learning it in different aspects of my life.
You know, so one of the things I say in my mentoring programs a lot is that the process is the goal. And that just kind of frustrates the heck out of a lot of highly sensitive entrepreneurs. They don't want to hear that. They want to hear that instead there's some formula that will get to the perfect, you know, solution or perfect package that then they can launch so that they won't actually have to be exposed. That's really the end game for so many highly sensitive. They want to stay in being able to be protected, because they're so used to getting overwhelmed by the onslaught, you know, of stimulation. And yet, again, trading perfectionism for process, and as you can allow that to happen, one, you get so much more done, but two, it's so much more enjoyable. Like,
yeah,
you start, it's really fun.
Yeah. When you start thinking about, like, as a perfectionist, you're kind of doing it wrong, because if you need the feedback from having stuff out there and actually learning how to do things better and sure, I can like keep on having more ideas to make my point perfectly clear, and I'll end up with like a 20,000 word blog post. But actually, perfectionist may be being able to write it in like 2,000 words. But I need to learn the process of like refining it down and like kicking my ass about when I get things wrong and actually sort of improving on it rather than just sort of keeping it in the shadow of like, oh, and there's this other thing I can add to it and stuff.
Definitely. Well, I would say it's also a reflection of the times that we're living in, right? So we're at this really interesting time, in my opinion, in the world. We're, you know, straddling centuries, right? Mm. And the last century was so much of the latter past of the last century was people trying to break out of, you know, so many structures. And yet there's still that mindset of, oh, if I can just know the rules and then I'll be safe. And we're entering into like this amazing time where there's so much available to us and those rules just no longer apply. And so it's, again, that straddle, which is like, great, like we have all this freedom, right? Like just even the fact that you and I are connecting right now and we can have this great conversation and people still want the safety of the structure and the rules. So you have to, you know, you have to kind of be willing to like take it all, not just the, you know, the safe freedom, but all freedom.
Yeah. As someone working with highly sensitive people, one thing that I've been feeling as a highly sensitive, maybe, person who takes things seriously is like, I do take climate change very seriously. And when you watch like a documentary where they're like, oh, look at this plastic and like, oh, this beautiful albatross has died from plastic. I'm like, shit, I used plastic once. Oh God, it's all my fault. And you feel very like you're responsible for everything. And I don't think that's the most useful way of actually thinking about it, as in you should be responsible for your own things, but you shouldn't feel responsible for the entire planet exactly.
Right.
You'd sort of know that other people are dealing with things. And if you did, you'd feel a lot more empowered to actually do more yourself just to sort of make sure that you're covered kind of thing. And it's kind of odd. But how do you think highly sensitive people should view climate change then?
That's what I wanted to ask. I would say what I really hear you speaking to is one of the shadows that I've identified, which is over-responsibility. And that is definitely a tendency for those of us who are highly sensitive, whether it's feeling over-responsible for climate change or just over-responsible for your friends' feelings or over-responsible for your family, whatever it might be. It's not a helpful, as you said, use of our highly sensitive traits. So back to that retraining, right? To learn how to shift that sense of over-responsibility, you know, into our strength of empathy. And when you're able to be empathetic, that's a really, really valuable trait. It's a really valuable ability. It allows you to put yourself in someone else's shoes. It allows you to think beyond just yourself. And it also allows you to then take action, where over responsibility, when you're in that shadow, tends to be quite crippling, right? You get very overwhelmed with a sense of gloom and doom, and you know, a real sense of like, I'm helpless here. That would be more of like the coping mechanism of hiding that I was speaking about earlier. Or you go into kind of overaction mode, more into that coping mechanism of pushing and trying to just take on everything and fix everything for everyone. And that doesn't work either. So if you can access instead that strength of empathy and then choose an action, what is the part that I can play? How am I meant to, you know, contribute to this shift in climate change? You know, what does that mean for me? Is it about, you know, what I use in my own household? Does that feel complete? Is it about that I'm meant to join, you know, some type of committee? Does it mean for me that I'm meant to, you know, be making phone calls to government officials? I don't know. It's different for everyone. But again, over responsibility, you know, tends to leave you ineffective at the end of the day. Empathy allows you to choose an action that's most aligned with you has you making a difference, but in a way that has you, you know, energized rather than exhausted. So that's what I see.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. And do you think like watching a lot of the things can leave you feel very sort of isolated, and it's sort of the same as if you, as it makes you sort of sound like you're the one educated listening to this thing, but no one else is doing anything. And you're like, shit, I've got to do everything. And it was like, imagine if your country was, you lived somewhere where like no one paid any tax, but they're like, oh, you're sensible. You understand economics. You need to pay tax for everyone here. You'd be like, fuck man, you've got the wrong person. Maybe, so you don't do anything at all. You're like, I'll just not pay tax like anyone else.
And yeah.
Like, obviously that's ridiculous, but that's sort of how you feel about climate change when you watch something and you sort of feel like you're the only person thinking about it.
Right. Well, one of the things that I like to say in my work is just because you can feel it doesn't mean that you are solely responsible for it. Right. So again, whether you really feel as a highly sensitive the impact of climate change, or whether you feel the fact of how, you know, sad your partner is, just because you can feel it doesn't mean that you're solely responsible for it. You can make a choice. And that's again, when you're accessing empathy. Okay, what is my part here? What do I choose to do? And that's going to make all the difference versus, again, being flooded by that sense of, oh my gosh, this is, you know, so big, so much, too big, too much, not helpful for anyone, yourself included.
Yeah, for sure. That's really useful for me. Thank you very much. Add that in other things as well as climate change. Like, as in, I do love helping people and coaching them, but I do feel sort of almost overly responsible for them. And I do kind of take it a bit too seriously sometimes when actually it could be a bit more just chilled out about it. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, and what's like really important to remember there, I mean, this is again, so much of what I do, because highly sensitives, whether they're a coach or they're typically in some service-based business, right, is that sense of over-responsibility is actually not of service to those that you're serving. So it's kind of a little bit of a mind game, and again, a retraining for the highly sensitive. It doesn't mean that you don't care when you dial back from being over-responsible, but actually as you are, again, able to, you know, bring that over-responsibility down, or like you said, to chill out, then you ironically are actually able to be of better service to those that you're coaching or, you know, counseling or serving in whatever way it might be.
Cool. All right. Okay. Thank you so much. What is the kindest thing that someone has ever done for you?
Well, the first thing that just popped into my head is I have worked with my personal spiritual teacher for over 25 years now. And when I first connected with her, when I was in graduate school, I think maybe, I can't remember if I had met with her once or not, but I was kind of like, oh, I don't think I can do this. And she called me up and she was like, we need to do this. And it was probably the kindest thing, because she took a stand for me. She didn't listen to my ridiculous excuses and really held that door open, and has then therefore been, you know, this massive positive force in my life, you know, every day since. So that was a massive act of kindness.
Yeah, it's lovely. But then it does sort of like counteract your point before of like not taking too much responsibility for people that you're trying to help and chilling out a bit more. And as in, it sounds like she took some good responsibility and was like, nah, Heather's going to do this and I'm going to make her do it.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say like the over-responsibility probably would have been like her, you know, like, oh, I'm going to do this for you, right? Instead, it was very much like, you know, like a matter of fact and reaching out. But at the end of the day, the decision was mine.
Okay, so she's being more empathetic, as you said, to your situation, sort of being more applicable to what you actually needed, rather than being like, I'm going to make you do it, so I'm going to half do it for you. And
right.
Yeah. Cool. I'm glad that we had this example, because that's definitely sort of the blurry lines where you can kind of get confused. Okay, then the other question is, what's one of your earliest memories from childhood that sort of is quite distinct?
I would say my earliest memory from childhood is I was in my crib. So I had to be somewhere, I think I was like around 2 years old. I remember there was a window like right next to the right side of my crib and the sun was shining in and like there's kind of like a breeze blowing the curtains. And I wanted to like reach for the sun. And as a result, I ended up toppling out of my crib and knocking my two front teeth like into, they weren't even fully formed yet, but they just shoved up further into my gums. And I don't remember the actual falling out. I remember the sun, I remember the curtain, I remember the reaching for it. And then the next thing I remember is kind of just having I was in my mother's arms and having like this moving backwards view of the apartment that we lived in at the time. As you know, later I understand she had like scooped me up and she was like rushing out of the apartment down the stairs into the hospital because there was blood everywhere. But those two distinct images, the sun and the window and the curtains, and then the apartment moving backward, that is my earliest memory.
Yeah, wow, that sounds quite vivid and very early, I must say, being two, but yeah.
I have a really good memory. I have a good relational memory. So I have a lot that I remember from early years. And that is definitely one, probably because again, it was so, you know, intense is why, although again, the intensity is not the memory. The intensity is stories that have been told to me since. The memory is actually quite calm and peaceful, which is very interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Cool, okay. And then do you have any questions for me before we finish?
Yes. What is your most prominent early memory?
I think for some reason, we used to have a dog and he was kind of like a little bit blind, but I think maybe only like two or three. And so like really, really early, and I didn't really quite get what a dog was or what it was doing and things. And yeah. I remember jumping on his tail and him being kind of annoyed and scared by it and running away. And I was basically being a dick apparently. And I remember him sort of like running away and being really nice about it until he eventually just was like, fuck this. I was like, oh shit, I've done a bad thing, mom. Yeah, I learned that maybe you shouldn't jump on dog's tails.
Right, yes, a real moment of discovery, right?
Yeah. You learn things by breaking them and doing it wrong. Not by breaking yourself, but you know, as in like stepping over the boundary too far.
Right.
But yeah, that was a lesson I had from early childhood.
Yes. Well, I love it because again, it's a moment of discovery, right? That precious moment where there's the moment when you didn't know.
You know, yeah. It's definitely all of my early memories were like something kind of just like changed at quite a big level in your brain and you suddenly go, whoa, this is like how I should be thinking about this thing.
Right. Oh, this is a dog's tail, which you can't ride. You can't sit on. And the dog actually will then, you know, that will trigger a certain response. And then from that point forward, your brain knew.
Yeah, cool. Well, yeah, I've had lots of fun. If you just give us your like website or medium of contact, I don't know, social media or whatever.
Yes. Well, I think probably the best is to start with www.hsequiz.com. And there you'll find an assessment. Once you take that assessment, you will know if you are either somewhat of an HSE or if you're a super HSE or if you're like me and you're a super uber HSE. So back to that spectrum we were talking about earlier. And then depending on where you fall, somewhat super or super uber, you'll also receive a free HSE success guide that will give you some first steps to learn how to begin to work with this aspect of yourself. And that's a great place to start and a great way for us to stay in touch, hsequiz.com.
Cool. Thank you very much. My absolute pleasure having you on the podcast.
Likewise. Thank you.
That was a crazy, fascinating, and interesting interview. I did not really expect it to go where it went. Well, yeah, as you may have noticed, I was a bit surprised that I kind of unprepared for who it was, and I kind of forgotten why I'd actually accepted to interview her. And I was like, ah, the HSE lady. Yes, you sound really fascinating. And yeah, she was really fascinating. And there is still a tiny bit of me that's a bit skeptic about this term. Anyway, the highly sensitive label, I'm just not a fan of labeling things, but like Hella says, it isn't black and white anyway, and it is a spectrum. And I think we are all highly sensitive at times to some degree, but then I am without a doubt someone who experiences a lot of the traits that she outlines. So maybe I'm just naively assuming that everyone experiences them as well, and perhaps they don't. It's hard to really know because the technology to be inside someone else's brain does not exist for now, so I can only guess. But anyway, the more important thing is that all of her advice was really, really good. And so regardless of whether you are a skeptic about highly sensitive entrepreneurs or not, you can still listen to her advice because it's really useful. And in the same way that I'm not a woman, but Catherine Binkley's advice, who is a female entrepreneur coach, that was really good. So I think we can still learn from the HSE coaches in the world, or Heather, because she's the only one of them. Although on that note about me not being a woman, maybe I am a woman, according to the podcast with Nam Kostuki. Who knows? Well, anyway, let's move on to the top tips. So, number one, don't make a big deal about someone else's disasters. Like, this is really big, because I really hate it when I have a problem and then everyone's like, oh, Sam, what's your problem? Let's deal with your problem. I'm like, oh, go away. So when something goes wrong for someone and they just want to heal in their own space and blend in with things, they don't want everyone's attention. So just try and make them feel normal. And okay, there are some weird people that really crave lots of attention and won't stop going on about things. But then these people are slightly mental and it's probably healthy for them to not have so much attention. So again, the same advice, kind of ignore them and just let them blend in. I think it works. Right, number two, well, two and three, about she just has some really good mindset shifts about how to approach things. So the first one, number two, is turn complaining into creativity. And I love this. Complaining gets you nowhere and it just wastes your time and the other people that you might be complaining to. And it's just negative energy, making more negative energy, and it's quite pointless. So instead, use this energy to be creative and build solutions, improve your life and those of others. Number three, turn perfectionism into process. Because perfection is your own biggest enemy. It's just deeply ironic that seeking perfection is the very thing that holds you back from achieving it. Like, you have to go through the pain of letting your imperfect creations and ideas into the world and become comfortable with the process of not being amazingly perfect. And yes, there will be problems and mistakes and errors, and sometimes you might look silly, but you probably won't. And if you're doing something that's crap, probably no one's looking in the first place. And then that's how you learn to improve. That's how you develop a body of work and you can get recognized for it. And I'll be honest myself with my podcast, it took me 8 months from when I first recorded an episode until I released it, because I was like fanning around trying to make everything perfect. And if I just released it much faster, it would have been about like 5% worse, maybe even less than that. But by the time the 8 months came around where I did actually release it, I would have been so much better at podcasting. And like now every podcast that I make is so much better than anything I could have come out with at the start, but I was trying to achieve perfection that wouldn't have happened anyway. Whereas I just get so much better by just doing so many of them. And yeah, it's just a really foolish way to try and do things, is to try and be perfect from the get-go. And you just get so much better at things by just doing it repeatedly and putting a process around it that makes sure that you deliver more stuff and learn from it. So basically, yes, make a process, ensure you deliver things, and then you'll become a reliable, useful human being and maybe get closer at least to perfection. And that's huge. And yeah, on that note, that is the end of the podcast. Did not have time to ask her about books, which is fine. I have too many books in my life anyway. I'm sure she's read lots of really good books, like most people who are interesting. But we guess I shall never know which ones they are. And do take her test. I am about to go and take it myself and excited to see what the results are. Have an awesome week, people. And Catch you next time on the podcast.
You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at SamHarrisTweets or Instagram at SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.